the Workforce Commission to order. And you all have a name tag in your folder.
That's crazy.
Well, I think everybody here can. And we're going to get permanent one nameplates, but they're not ready yet. There on the agenda, the first item is the election of what it says in the legislation that it's the election of the chair, but I would prefer that we elect co-chairs like most of the commissions that have senators and House members. And are there any, obviously there should be one from the Senate. Senator Lord.
Representative Huntley, I would, from the Senate, nominate Senator Claussen.
Okay. Any other nominations from the Senate? Okay. All those in favor of Senator Claussen being the co-chair?
Aye.
Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So I've already violated my first rule because I was just telling people that if you're going to say aye in this committee, you should say you betcha. okay. Nominations for the House member.
I'll nominate Representative Huntley, I guess.
Okay. Thank you. Any other nominations? I'll be gone in 6 months, so you don't have to.
I think we're done January 1st.
right around there. Any other nominations? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
You bet.
Aye. Opposed? Oh. So Senator Claussen and Representative Huntley are the co-chairs. And with that, do I want to go through the overview? I'm going to call on Mark Schoenbaum to give us an overview of what we put in the legislature this past year about this commission. So, Mr. Schoenbaum from the Department of Health.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I've got a couple of items on the agenda today, and had the opportunity to present before various legislative commissions before. For those of you that haven't had the opportunity to meet, I'm from the part of the health department that is assigned to collect, analyze, and develop the healthcare workforce in the state. We're actually located in the Department's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, which has a very broad portfolio. We were very pleased and honored to be included in the legislation as a resource for you as a commission. We take that seriously, so we've done some pre-work that we had an opportunity, some of which to share with Representative Huntley, and we'll walk through all that together. I think next on the agenda is just a review of the charge, and I can do that, Representative Huntley, unless you know you as the author would prefer.
Why don't you go through it, Mr. Schoenbaum?
Thank you. So it's a handout from past session's health policy bill. No, maybe it was the finance bill. But anyway, from one of the omnibus bills last session. Talks about your goal as a commission, study and make recommendations to the legislature on achieving the goals of strengthening the workforce in healthcare. Lays out your membership, officers, organizational items like appointments and meeting, and gives you your initial assignment to provide a preliminary report with recommendations by this December 31st. Gives you final assignment to report again in 2016, after which you expire. The contents of the report which could be what shapes your work plan, at least for these next 6 months, are items 1 through 4 at the bottom of the page. Maybe I'll save that for the next item because I've plugged them into a draft work plan for your discussion, which we can get to in a moment.
Okay, go ahead.
Why don't you pull out, you have a handout. And landscape, you have a couple of landscape handouts. Let's first look at the one called First Draft Work Plan July through December. Those of you that have heard me present before know that I usually present on kind of the content area, facts and figures about the healthcare workforce, and we'll do some of that today. But you've also put us in a different role as kind of a staff resource to all of you, so we've taken the liberty of attempting to help you frame your activities for at least this next 6 months, and that first try is on this handout. And you can see your major charges laid out on the left column there, and it goes over to the second page. Identify current and anticipated workforce shortages, evaluate the effectiveness of incentives, study alternative incentives to meet your goals, and your fourth charge has a specific focus on the primary care workforce. What this preliminary work plan does is it basically plugs in moving through these charges, developing and considering recommendations, and making decisions on what to incorporate in your report in a series of 5 meetings between now and the end of December. And again, that was just kind of a first attempt to try and sort and organize and time activities. We are here at the first meeting, and today's agenda matches that. We would continue on through the fall. There are a couple of related activities assigned by the legislature that this work plan pulls in and attempts to intersect and ideally coordinate. So you will see in the middle on the bottom, the schedule calls for an update on the Mental Health Workforce Summit. That was an effort that the legislature chartered in the 2012 session, was it? Senator Wicklin? Senator Claussen?
Yes.
And Senator Claussen is deeply involved in that and I think would be in a good position for an update on that. In the next column there, in the last session, the legislature assigned the Commissioner of Health to create a task force to analyze and attempt to propose solution to barriers that immigrant and refugee physicians have resuming their practice in this country. That task force will soon begin its meetings. It's also assigned to come up with recommendations by the end of the year. Seemed related, so you may want to hear an update on that project as well. So that's plugged in to the work plan. We know there are many other resource people and stakeholders, institutions, employers, interested parties of all kind that you will likely want to hear from. There aren't any public testimony slots built into the work plan yet, but I'm sure you will want to discuss how you want to hear from others as you go along.
Yeah, for those members, this was intended to simply be a proposal, and if the commission wants to do things in a different order or do different things, then let us know, and we'll try to adapt to that. But this is just sort of a general overview of what we might do.
Exactly, Representative Huntley. So feel free. Again, this is kind of preliminary noodling before you'd even begun to meet, just to give you a head start. So by all means, please weigh in.
Okay, want to continue?
Okay, well, I will leave that with you as food for thought, and we can maybe zero in on some of the details as we think about the next meeting. I do have a formal presentation.
Okay, well, go ahead with that.
Okay. I do have a formal presentation, and you have the PowerPoint slides, two to a page, as well as a couple of handouts that I will refer to. Again, this is a mix of some opening overview and background material on the healthcare workforce itself, and also some opening ideas on kind of common approaches to thinking about addressing workforce needs. I like this quote on the second slide here after the title slide from a colleague in North Carolina, who I think really kind of gets the importance of what you are up to here. Many policy levers that affect the supply, distribution, and skill mix of the health workforce are state-based, including licensure and scope of practice regulations, state loan repayment programs, and Medicaid reimbursement rates. State-level decisions about whether to enact or change policies directed at training, recruiting, and retaining health professionals affect a wide range of stakeholders. I think that says it pretty well. Back to the basics here for our first meeting, just to lay out the breadth of what we mean when we talk about the healthcare workforce. Moving on to the next slide, you will see an excerpt from this handout with the graph at the top and the word Minnesota. The excerpt, you know, shows us what a major sector of the economy and the workforce healthcare represents. Not quite 400,000 jobs, 13% of state employment. And under this analysis, prepared a couple years ago by Georgetown University, they did both a national analysis and a look at each state. You can see that healthcare employment is expected to grow fast and faster than the rest of the economy. If you take a look at the rest of this handout, we can get in. We don't need to get into kind of the supply and demand projections, but I think this is one of the best snapshots I've found, all on a page or two, particularly if you turn it over, that just starts to list all in one place the range of healthcare occupations. Part of your charge relates to the primary care workforce, which is central to the health system. But as you can see, the breadth of healthcare jobs is very wide and occurs in multiple settings. Clinics, hospitals, long-term care, home care, ambulance, and on and on. So this is a major issue in the economy, and, of course, it fuels the healthcare system.
Shedding a little light on the subject. And by the way, if you have questions for anybody that's presenting, just
call my attention, and I'll call on you to ask those questions.
So you as a commission, moving on to this next slide, planning framework, you as a commission have a charge to look at the situation and come up with some recommendations. There's any number of ways to frame that up, to go about it. One way is laid out here, which is to try and get your arms around how many health professionals will we need, given the incumbent workforce that we have and given, you know, what creates demand for health services. And you can see some of those factors listed there, age, population growth, et cetera. So how many do we need? How many do we have? How many do we need? How many do we expect to be produced both through our education system and through folks who choose to relocate here? And basically, X minus Y, how much of a gap or a surplus do we expect? What strategies can be considered to address that surplus? Both financial strategies, regulatory strategies, and what effects the evolution in technology and the transformation of the healthcare delivery system will have on workforce needs. Sounds pretty logical when you put it on a slide, but of course, it gets messy pretty quickly. And as we look at that healthcare workforce, what are the steps? What are the pieces and the sequences that it takes to have that workforce in place? One common way to look at this, that workforce development folks look at this, is to talk about the workforce development pipeline, and that applies to the healthcare workforce along with every other employment sector. So we need kids who are interested and prepared to enter these fields. We have to attract them, both traditional and non-traditional students, to enter education in the fields. We have to give them the education and training that they need to provide what we need and the quality that we need, where we're going to need it. Once they graduate with those credentials, given our supply and demand situation, they're going to have lots of choices. So how do we encourage them to work in those high-need settings where we need them most? What changes can we make in those settings themselves that will both appeal to them and help solve our workforce problems? And once they're there, how do we keep them wanting to stay there? Again, another oversimple way of thinking about the healthcare workforce, but particularly as you look at, as you consider recommendations, this can be a useful framework to think about the effects of each of the options that will come before you and look at where all the things you're doing now fit and what those effects are. Let's look at the next handout. Another landscape page. And what this handout has, what this grid has, is it has that workforce pipeline that we looked at a moment ago. And we've attempted to plug in as many of the current programs, interventions, approaches, strategies that state government is involved in as we could think of and that as we had room for. So it's not comprehensive, but again, today's purpose is just to kind of get you thinking about the breadth and the options that you will have before you. So going from left to right, if we look at what the state is doing to attract and prepare kids to enter health professions education, You can see that a number of things are going on by a number of state actors, from the Department of Education to us at the Health Department to the MnSCU system to Department of Employment and Economic Development, the U and others. Once they're prepared, we're doing a variety of activities to help them, to attract them and help them enter and succeed in health professions education. And you can see those in the second column. Any questions about any of these, or if you want me to move a little slower, I'm happy to do that.
No questions.
In the center, in the health professions especially, in addition to classroom education, clinical training is essential to prepare qualified workers. And you can see some of what state government supports in that middle column. Moving on, about what we do to encourage people to work where they're most needed, you can see the range of programs here. They are some state and some federal. Loan forgiveness, visa waivers, recruiting support, and a couple others. You can see the delivery system, moving again, second to the last column. The delivery system changes that are underway that have an effect on the healthcare workforce. And some of what the legislature and state government and others do to assure that people stay in place for the long term and succeed. So back to our framework. How do you know? How do you want to organize your work? Any questions on that grid at all?
No.
Back to that framework. You have a charge two, that asks you to analyze the effects of current investments. And I think you'll probably want to spend some time on that. Once you understand that, as much as we'll all be able to do together, you know, you'll have a variety of choices for recommendations. And again, you make these decisions every year, but thought it couldn't hurt to lay them out. And referring back to where different choices will have an effect in the pipeline. Those are some of the kind of the big picture framing thoughts we have for you today. Let's do turn our attention briefly, and the Medical Association will dive into this deeper, on what we know about the supply and demand in the healthcare workforce. Big picture, if you look at this chart, and many of you have seen this before, the bottom line in blue shows that some of the central occupations in our healthcare workforce mirror the baby boom demographics in the population at large. Physicians, nurses especially, they will be growing older and leaving the workforce. The red line above, that baby boomer population will be needing more health services as it ages, and you can see that demand projection there. The yellow line in the middle is what we know from our educational systems about the volume of health professionals they will be graduating. And you can see that looking big picture, we have a problem. The green line at the top, there's been a lot of discussion about the effects of on workforce of newly covered people seeking care. There will be an effect, although it's hard to get your arms around it. But you can see, given the underlying dynamics, it will only be an effect at the margins rather than being the central problem itself. At the Health Department, on behalf of the federal government, we analyze and report areas of the state that suffer from health care shortages, and you can see those maps for what are called health professional shortage areas on the next slide. And there are significant areas of the state that have official shortages according to federal criteria in primary care, in mental health, and in dentistry. The map in the lower right corner is another federal categorization that looks not only at provider numbers, but at some of the underlying demographics that create high need for health services. And you can see many areas of the state also have that underserved area designation. You have a charge about primary care, and I presented at least to the House Committee on this subject in the past, and you'll hear shortly from the Medical Association. There is a lot of logic to focusing on primary care. Some of the things we know about it are that it leads to better health outcomes, higher patient satisfaction, and lower health care spending. This is the makeup of the primary care, moving on to the pie chart. This is the makeup of the primary care workforce in Minnesota. You can see that the largest chunk of it is physicians, but that nurse practitioners and physician assistants are also a significant share of our primary care workforce. Here you can see the age profile of these central primary care providers. It's interesting to note, I'm not sure how this will play into your deliberations, that as I'd mentioned, nurse practitioners and physicians do have that boomer shape, curve, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to get in trouble here. But physician assistants are pretty young, which is an interesting phenomenon. And the number of physician assistant programs in the state is growing. So that's a resource that you may want to try and factor in as you move along. And on this next slide, that is a combination of bar graphs and a pie chart, you can see that particularly in the state's isolated rural areas, our smallest, most remote areas, the number of primary care providers, the share of primary care providers is less than the population share in those isolated rural areas. So that points out an area that you may want to attend to. Similarly, we know that the race and ethnicity of our healthcare workforce, our primary care workforce, does not match the ethnicity of our population. People want to know how big, how many of this, that, and the other are we going to be short? And here are a number of projections. Here are a number of projections, all more or less within a range. The Hospital Association came out with an impressive report just this morning. Their number is about 850 primary care physicians short within the next 10 years. I'm not sure which number is right, but I think it is telling that no one is projecting a surplus of primary care physicians. We've talked about a couple of these related efforts that a couple I think you know are pretty closely related, and I plug them in as updates into that draft work plan. A couple of others that have happened in the recent past or are underway now. The Governor's Health Reform Task Force issued a broad set of recommendations in 2012. It had a section on the healthcare workforce, which may merit your review. The Medical Association, you will hear from next. The University Higher Education Committees in I believe it was, I'm not sure if it was 2012 or 2013, asked the university to weigh in on how many physicians by specialty they would produce and what need they saw. They did produce, they did deliver that report. Underway in a parallel track to the timeline of this commission is a National Governors Association Health Care Workforce Policy Academy that the governor's office applied for and will receive some outside expertise for a group of state agency leaders, higher education leaders, training institutions, and the hospital association to work on. Something else where I think there may be some intersection, we may want to stay in touch with that, and I've mentioned these last two already. So there is a lot going on healthcare workforce issues right now, and you may want to coordinate your work with some of that.
For those that don't, the National Governors Association, I think we are one of like five or six states that...
I think that's right. Six? Seven.
Seven. Okay. So, again, Minnesota's sort of at the lead.
And that's, that. There's no money that came with that, but it is an opportunity to kind of convene a group of work, health workforce leaders and get some outside insights and some outside resources available as well. That's what the National Governors Association promises to bring. Let's talk about the mental health workforce for just a minute. We looked a moment ago at the breadth of healthcare occupations, big picture, kind of wherever you would choose to look, and you will also find in each healthcare sector, another range of occupations. So we may think, at least I may, I thought I had an understanding of who was a mental health professional, but here's the list that Senator Claussen's group has been working with, and whether we look at long-term care or medical specialties, we will find the same kind of complexity.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question in regards to the mental health occupations. I've noticed in some other places physicians' assistants were listed. I don't see them here in the mental health occupations. Could you explain, are they included? Are they there? I mean, it seems an obvious thing, but I just wanted to check because I didn't notice them listed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, this is the list that the Mental Health Summit Group has been using, and I'm not sure exactly how they've included or occupations on the list or left them off the list. Part of the challenge, no matter what sector we look at, is it does get complex, you know, so quickly that it's often hard to capture everything. But you make a good point.
And I do know that there are nurse midwives that are in the psychiatric area, but I do not know about physician assistants.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, especially on our initial meeting, we need to be sure we have the universe, the full universe of professions when we're talking about this area, and that seems to be one of them. So maybe we could just be sure we include that.
And Senator Claussen, when is their final report coming out from that meeting?
Mr. Chair, our final report is due in January 2015.
Then I think we should coordinate with them prior to that. It was eye-opening. I went to that meeting, and it was eye-opening to me because I know a lot about medicine, but I don't know as much about psychiatry and the number of different kinds of workers they have in that field, which they need.
are, because a lot of these people need more family social kinds of supports than a lot of people with a standard physical illness. And you need different kinds of workers to deliver those services.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, and that's why I wanted to be sure that we included all of them, because they're all valuable, they're all important, they all have a good role to play in it. So,
continuing on, and maybe just one more point to your question, Senator Kiffmeyer, I also noticed that clinical nurse specialists, nurse practitioners are also not on this list. I believe the Summit Group may have chosen to focus on the kind of the classic traditional providers that are reimbursed by the Department of Human Service mental health programs, and I think that may be part of the origin of this list. Here's just the start at trying to add some of the details to that grid of state investments in the healthcare workforce. These are some of the activities that take place at the health department. We have easy numbers on these and can share them with you today. As you go forward, you may want to look for the same kind of level of detail in all your other areas of interest. Nobody's told me yet they're tired of my fishing analogy, so I'm going to keep using it. I think of the healthcare workforce often, you know, as the big lake, and we need to be the best fishermen we can be to capture all the fish that are in the lake. But there aren't enough fish to meet those shortages that we see coming. So looking at redesigning practices, looking at scope of practice changes, looking at emerging professions who can fill gaps here and there, such as community health workers, community paramedics, who can fill gaps, extend the reach of traditional providers. All of these are going to be key to getting as close as we can to addressing our workforce needs. And here is a list of those emerging professions. So that's a quick overview, some ways to look at your work, to look at the healthcare workforce structurally, and a beginning look at some of the facts and figures. I hope that's been of some use, and invite you to kind of share thoughts now, or we can mull it over as we plan out the next number of months.
Any questions? I don't see any. Are we going to Mr. Berg now?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just as Mr. Berg has arrived, in thinking about, again, trying to think step by step logically at how you might address your assignment here, understanding the problem, understanding the need, understanding how much we as a state are investing in addressing that need, figuring out what's the remaining need and how you might want to respond to that, it seemed there could be productive try and understand what the state is now spending on health professions, education, and development. So Mr. Berg has agreed to get us started in that conversation.
Chairs, members, I'm Doug Berg. I'm a fiscal analyst for Human Services here in the House. And after that buildup on how I'm actually not going to tell you what we spent on this now, but hopefully I think maybe Mr. Schoenbaum and I had talked a little bit that I'll just spend a minute or two talking about kind of how the legislature has approached this issue a little bit. And I kind of get the the call on that because I have sort of the dubious distinction of having been around here long enough to have worked as the primary analyst for all the committees that have jurisdiction over parts of this issue, which I guess are kind of primarily three. Some of this won't be news to a lot of the members who've been around, but the Higher Education Committee, and I was the higher ed analyst for many years, is maybe the, well, certainly the committee that spends the most money on producing healthcare workforce workers. I mean, that committee funds the primary pipeline for our workers in this. That said, that committee doesn't spend a lot of time thinking in an organized fashion about what is our healthcare workforce need and how should we address it. It does come up sometimes. There have been initiatives out of the colleges, and Representative Pawlowski is very familiar with our efforts to expand, for instance, the slots for nursing education and things that have happened in a very thoughtful plan to buy more slots or buy a bigger pipeline. That said, that pipeline in some cases, we'll get into an interesting discussion that Mr. Schoenbaum and I had, in some cases you probably can't buy a bigger pipeline or it won't be very easy to do, and physician training is at the top of the list there. Just having more physicians is not going to be an easy thing to do, and that gets into the next committee, or I guess what I'll say is that you get to is the jurisdictional issues. The Human Services Committee doesn't spend anywhere near as much money on production of healthcare workforce people, but maybe from the legislative perspective is the committee that's most interested in that issue. The Human Services Committee and its constituencies are pretty concerned with, are we going to have enough people to do the jobs that we see out there for them? And Mr. Schoenbaum's office, he mentioned some things there, you know, looking at shortage areas, critical shortage areas. Merck, which is on the chart that the matrix he passed out, we didn't talk about it a lot, but is a advanced training, its residencies and clinical slots. That's a big chunk of money that goes for advanced training. It isn't big enough, and there aren't enough slots, and that's a big issue, and that's one we'll get into. And it's one where you see the problem between the committees. If, in fact, we could just produce more physician graduates out of the University of Minnesota or Mayo Medical Schools, and I think that in and of itself would be a complicated issue, there isn't anywhere for them to get their residencies at this point. So we can't just say, let's make the pipeline bigger over in the humans, in the higher ed committee, because even if you could make the pipeline bigger there, the product wouldn't go anywhere. It would have to go out of state at this point. And also the Workforce Economic Development Committee, I also have had some connection with over the years. And it thinks about this issue less as a healthcare workforce issue and more in its general labor market area, although there are a few things that also were on Mr. Schoenbaum's matrix that I think are interesting for discussion and will be increasingly important, and those are things like the visa issues and the training of foreign doctor issues. If you think about the implications of not really being able to make the pipeline bigger on the higher education end easily on some of these things, then you pretty quickly get over into the economic development area of what can we do to train people who've been to attract people who've been trained elsewhere. And I won't have to tell senior members who've been there, Representative Huntley, Representative Pawlowski, Senator Laurie, the committees that are interested in this and fund this don't talk to each other in an organized fashion about it at the legislature, and that's maybe one of the biggest things I would say after a number of years of working around this issue. The Higher Ed Committee is concerned with its, you know, and it's not that the universities don't respond to the labor market, they do, but the Higher Ed Committee does not sit and think, what does the Human Services Committee need for higher education workforce? And the Human Services Committee does not sit around and think, what else does the Higher Ed Committee have to do? And so this is an issue that has been around these jurisdictions for a long time, but which I would say has never been dealt with in any kind of organized fashion across jurisdictions.
Wow.
And I maybe will leave it there to just start the discussion. I mentioned the limitations. The higher ed committee, you can only make the pipeline bigger in some cases. There are, the health department runs a number of programs that I would say deal with the distribution, like loan forgiveness programs, the RPAP program. Those programs work. They're effective, but they're small scale, and they don't increase the number of people in the workforce. They just get them to go places where you don't have them now, and so they're an effective way to help certain areas, but they don't get more people in. And economic development, I don't know. There's a lot of those that cut across federal jurisdictions, and so, and there, oh, I, one other thing I would mention is licensure. While training happens in the higher ed committee, licensure happens over in the human services committee, and you would think those two things would be very closely aligned, and for the people who have to be trained and licensed, they are, but legislatively, they aren't at all. The higher ed committee almost never talks about licensure, and the human services committees, when we talk about the licensure boards, they rarely, the boards are interested in education, but the committee rarely talks about the educational requirements. So I guess that's kind of where I would leave it to kind of touch off this discussion, and Mr. Schoenbaum and I had a far-ranging discussion that went.
Well, let me just reinforce what they've said. One of the problems, particularly with physician education, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and a lot of these other ones, is not an educational. The problem is not the educational system where you hire some lecturer or faculty member to come in and present a lecture or a series of lectures and grade it and give them a grade if they pass it. The real hang-up is the training sites out where the healthcare is delivered. And how do you fund that? And nobody has really figured out a good way to fund that. Now, there are, up until I think this fall, we've had only physician assistant school, Augsburg. I think St. Kate's is going to start this fall. And they started already. And then St. Scholastic is looking at it, and Bethel is looking at it. But it's not very difficult to hire the faculty members to teach these courses. The question is, where are they going to get the training, and how do you pay for that? And they can't all be lectured. They got to get out there and actually participate. And I can tell you that in the residency programs from the medical end, it's thought that it costs the hospital or whoever, the clinics that are training these people, about $150,000 per person per year. And that's not generally paid for by the educational system. And you have the same thing with a lot of the mental health workers. Where are they actually going to go and get the training dealing with patients? And we don't have a good system in this country to answer that question.
And Mr. Chair, I would add one thing that it seems, I think, obvious to people in this room and the policy people, but which I have found over the years is kind of a generic reaction in at least the public and even members of the legislature who haven't looked at this, which is, why do we have to pay for clinical slots? Because aren't the health plans or whoever, the physician's plan, aren't they getting free work out of these people? And it just, as I say, it bears, I think, making it quite clear that you have to pay someone to take residence and open up clinical slots because it slows down their throughput. You have to have senior staff supervise them. You have to pay them because they're actually working. So it is, I mean, there's just this natural reaction of, oh, they're getting free labor, so why does it cost money? Well, you have to pay for each of those clinical slots, or you don't have them.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Oh, Mr. Chair, yeah, my question was, is it that there are more sites that could work for clinical, right? And what's lacking is the clinical supervision reimbursement, so that they can be reimbursed for the needs of supervising a training program. But I think those are two different things. So are there sites that could work for clinical training purposes? And what's missing is that key. And do we have that in the studies here that show that there are hospitals, clinics, and sites that could be, that do have the patient volume and other things that are needed for being a clinical site? And what's lacking is the money for funding the supervision, as I would call it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, you ask a central question, and the commission may want to spend some time on that. It's not a short answer, but the short answer is yes. There are, you know, in theory, additional clinics, hospitals, pharmacies, other training sites that would be available if they could figure out, you know, how to support the kind of obligation that Mr. Berg mentioned. We do hear the health department administers the Merck training subsidy, and we do hear every year, the list of training sites changes every year because sites struggle to maintain, to meet that demand of having students in their practice, and they kind of come on and fall off accordingly. So we know there's some more capacity out there. Exactly how much, I'm not sure. But
and I will say that all the hospitals that are thinking about this are generally operating at a 2% profit margin, and they're all very concerned about, yes, they would like to hire those people, and yes, they would like to train them, but mm-hmm. is it going to affect their bottom line?
I think it would be really important, Mr. Chair, to kind of have, as a part of this, a survey or some sort, because this is where we talk about this, our work project, because it would be helpful to know what sites are there and who would be willing and who does have the volume and the quantity and the ability, and the only thing lacking is that. It would be nice to have that documented. I don't know if that is anywhere at all, but I think that would be helpful, too.
I will say on the medical end, there's another complication, and that's basically the feds determine the number, and it's been frozen since 97? I don't know what exact year it is. The number of slots in each specialty and where they're located. And so while it's true you could start a residency program and it would probably get approved, but if the feds aren't going to give any money for it, it's very difficult for the system to do that. And with nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, it's different because there really is no federal money for that. But for the residencies for physicians, it's really locked in by the feds.
Not only in regards to the quantity, but in the specialties as well. Is it broken down in that as well? Since 1997, well, the things have changed a lot. That sounds like a very archaic situation that hopefully maybe we can influence the feds to change something.
I could be very interested in that. But I give you an example. North Dakota has just started their own family practice residency program. No federal money is available. North Dakota's got a ton of money, and they could probably afford it. But I can tell you, I know some hospitals in North Dakota that really wanted to do education, but they figured they can't afford to take more family practice residency.
And, Mr. Chair, we had a model like that here some years ago, and I don't know the status of this right now because it's been some years since I did higher ed, but we did start a residency program at St. Cloud Hospital that was a family practice residency program where, because of those restrictions, the state of Minnesota paid 100% of the residency costs. Now, I think that has migrated over to the university, and I don't know if we still pay 100%. We still pay 100% of the cost in those 7 or 8 slots,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, one real back of the envelope way, and I don't remember the exact figure, so I'll give you a ballpark and I'll follow up. But the federal government, through Medicare, spends about $200 million, maybe a little less, on graduate medical education every year in Minnesota. The Merck program spent last year $57 million. We have recently begun to collect expenditure reports from the hundreds of sites, training sites that participate in the Merck program, and our rough tally, this is the figure I don't remember precisely, I think it's around $350 million they reported spending. So, you know, they are already contributing significantly more than is provided in support by either the state or federal government.
I like your back of the envelope. From an expert like this, you can kind of. Thank you.
I will tell you one other thing about the federal requirements. It goes back a long time in history, but basically the federal subsidy for residents in medicine is based on the number of hours that they spend in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Well, who spends all their time in the hospital is specialists. Mm-hmm. And the primary care doc's main job is to keep their patients out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. So there's a tilt in how the money is distributed.
Well, I think we've discussed this before. I just would like to see if we can leverage this commission to be a voice to the feds that says that 1997 and all of that, it is time to release that, hopefully totally, and let the states fund their needs for their citizens, either in a block grant or something like that, or certainly require a change in that whole structuring, because that's just compounding the problem in a very huge way. As I know, yes. You well know, Mr. Chair. Sorry, preaching to the choir there. I didn't mean to preach, just affirming your previously stated information.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Clausen.
Thank you. Just one comment. In looking at if we were able to expand residency slots, do we have the training institutions that can also expand capacity? I think that's another question that we have to ask along the way. We've talked about physician assistants, that we have some institutions coming on board with programs. But I think Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota system are two major training programs or educational institutions. Can they expand to mm-hmm. create a greater
There's role? A number of residency programs in a lot of the Twin Cities hospitals mm-hmm. that are not directly linked to either the university or Mayo. So they run their own residency programs.
It's a but capacity issue, right?
Are there more? That's one of the things we need to look into.
So I don't want to spend money, Mr. Chair, on funding something when there is a fundamental lack of capacity of our clinical sites. I think that's a key important area to know.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Senator Clausen, was that your question, though, or was it does the educational institutions have the capacity to produce more graduates to go into
Correct.
The training slots?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Is that another question, I think, is what you were trying to get at. And I don't know the answer to that either. I mean, I know we asked the U of M, I don't know, 18 months ago or something, and their response, you know, I summarize here, was basically, well, there's no residency slot, so we're not really going to mm-hmm. consider producing more graduates. It wasn't a real clear answer in my recollection of reading their response as to whether there was additional capacity at the U to produce the graduates to go into the training. So I don't know the answer to that either.
Well, we're going to need to really find out the details in this, and I can tell you that we are training more physicians are getting MD degrees in this country than there are slots available for them to do a residency. And it's like a third above what there are slots. In addition to that, we have foreign medical grads that come over here and compete for those residency slots. So, what I would like to do is get all that information out here and let us mm-hmm. pick away at it.
We can have you
So any other questions on this? And do we want to go to the MMA? Oh, Doug, were you going to continue?
Mr. Chair, that's all I had to comment on. We're just trying to kind of, at this point, I think, to start a discussion on where the commission wants to go a little bit and what it wants to do next.
Mr. Chairman, exactly. So I think our request or invitation to all of you is kind of think about kind of what how full a picture you'd like about kind of what you're investing now and kind of what we're doing with it. It'll take some work, but it could be important.
Okay. Why don't we think about that, and we can all generate some ideas and come back at our next meeting and we'll be ready to go, because my personal view is that I would like you to understand the issue and maybe not understand what the solutions would be, but at least understand the issue, and then we can start working on solutions. So why don't we go on to the MMA then? I think they're... Are they here? Oh, there they are. Welcome to the committee, and if you would state your name just for the record.
Jeremy Springer.
And I remember attending, Lucy and I attended one of your meetings.
Yes, you did. Members of the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission, my name is Jeremy Springer. I'm a family physician in St. Louis Park, and I am here today as the chair of the Minnesota Medical Association's Primary Care Physician Workforce Expansion Advisory Task Force. Large mouthful. The Minnesota Medical Association is a professional association of more than 10,000 physicians and physicians in training throughout Minnesota. I'm here today to report on the efforts of the MMA's Primary Care Physician Workforce Expansion Advisory Task Force, including the report and recommendations from that task force that have been approved by the MMA Board of Trustees. For my presentation today, I've included some slides to help guide the commission members through the work of the task force. I'd like to begin with an overview of the primary care physician workforce shortage. According to a September 2013 report of the Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, that as of 2011 to 2012, there were a total of 5,064 primary care physicians licensed to practice in Minnesota. Of these physicians, 50% were board certified in family medicine, 34% were board certified in general internal medicine, and 16% were board certified in general pediatrics. The Minnesota Department of Health report noted that although one-third of the primary care physicians are internists, the workforce survey conducted suggests that up to 30% of these physicians may actually be working as hospitalists in acute care settings and not in primary care clinics. In regards to age distribution of Minnesota primary care physician workforce, those who practice family medicine are the oldest and have the smallest amount or the least number of younger physicians, younger being defined as 34 years of age, that are available to replace them upon retirement. General internists and general pediatricians were younger, with the pediatricians being the youngest. The median ages were 49, 46, and 47 years, respectively. The Minnesota Department of Health report noted that many of the generalists may go on to subspecialize and therefore fall out of the primary care cohort. In regards to the rural-urban distribution of Minnesota primary care physician workforce, general family medicine, general internal medicine, and general pediatrics were found by the Minnesota Department of Health to be more highly concentrated in urban areas of the state, as is the population, and pediatricians and internists had the highest concentration in those areas. In rural areas, family medicine had the highest concentration, and there were few general internists and pediatricians found in the small and isolated rural areas of the state. Finally, in regards to regional distribution, the Minnesota Department of Health report found that the majority of Minnesota primary care physicians were located in the Twin Cities region. Those physicians practicing family medicine were found to be more distributed around the state when compared to the general internists and the pediatricians. In the Twin Cities region, there was a high concentration of pediatricians, and general internists were more highly concentrated in both the Twin Cities and southeast regions of the state, probably reflecting Mayo Clinic. The Association of American Medical Colleges projects a shortage of 45,000 primary care doctors by 2020 and a shortage of 65,000 primary care doctors by 2025. Here in Minnesota, we had 4,215 primary care physicians in 2010. It's estimated that Minnesota will need an approximately 1,187 additional primary care physicians by 2030. That's a 28% increase from the number seen in 2010. There are many factors that are contributing to the shortage. One of the factors is the aging population. For example, Minnesota's 65 and older population is expected to increase from 12 to 24% between 2000 and 2030. Elderly patients require more time to see the doctor more often and increase the need for providers. Another factor is our aging workforce, which is contributing to the shortage of primary care physicians. In 2010, one quarter of the 242,000 primary care physicians in the U.S. were 56 years or older. Here in Minnesota, more than one-third of primary care physicians were 55 or older in 2015. Additional factors that contribute to the shortage include a growing population, the fact that thousands of Minnesotans are gaining access to health care coverage due to the Affordable Care Act. There's been decreases in state funding for medical education, a steady decrease in the number of primary care physician residency slots, and a declining interest in primary care careers. Next, I want to provide the commission members with some background regarding our task force. Within MMA's five-year strategic plan, one of the goals is to help make Minnesotans the healthiest in the nation. One key strategy to help achieve the goal is to expand Minnesota's primary care workforce. The MMA Board of Trustees approved the formation of a task force to examine the issue in 2013. The task force was made up of 14 physicians. Over a 10-month period, six meetings were convened. At the May 2014 meeting of the MMA Board of Trustees, the task force final report and recommendations were approved by the board. At the July 2014 meeting of the MMA Board of Trustees, an implementation work plan for the recommendations was submitted, and the MMA staff is currently working to move this plan forward. On this slide is our task force charge. Some of our goals included examining the various drivers affecting the capacity and future supply of our primary care workforce, and identifying strategies in medical education, training, and practice settings for increasing the primary care physician workforce. The task force has three main deliverables. First, to plan and convene a summit. Second, to recommend to the MMA Board of Trustees policy positions. And third, to develop an action steps to launch community action on this issue. Here's a list of our task force members. We had members representing the state's medical schools, residency program leadership, medical students, residents, practicing community physicians, and hospital representatives. I want to provide the commission members with some information regarding the efforts of the task force. During our two task force meetings, the task force members felt that it was important to establish a definition of what constitutes a primary care physician. On the screen, you see what that primary care physician is as defined by the task force. We limited the definition to care provided by practitioners in specialties in family medicine, general internal medicine, and general pediatrics, and geriatrics. Next, the task force members were surveyed to assess what they saw as barriers to expanding the primary care physician workforce. The task force members ranked the barriers in the following order: primary care income differential compared to other specialties, number 2, perception of primary care among medical students, number 3, lifestyle challenges, number 4, limited residency slots, number 5, access to meaningful clinical experiences, 6th, cultural support for primary care within medical schools, 7, hassles for physicians associated with training. This is in regards to challenges that preceptors face in training medical students. Geographic maldistribution of primary care physicians. Number 9, unsupportive comments and experiences provided to students by primary care preceptors. And then uncertainty around the future of primary care.
Dr. Springer, could you explain what preceptor?
I'm sorry, preceptors are supervising physicians for folks that are in training. So whether it's a medical student or resident or whoever, the preceptor would be the faculty or the overseeing physician that would be guiding the student or resident and okaying what they're doing and checking to make sure that what they're doing is correct, obviously, and making sure that they're not, that they're taking good care of the patient. Next, the task force members were surveyed to assess, during the course of our efforts, two informational surveys were also conducted. The first survey was of medical students at the University of Minnesota Medical School and the Mayo Medical School. The medical students were surveyed to assess their perception of primary care. A total of 1,011 medical students were surveyed, with more than 10% responding at 142 medical students. Some positive responses received regarding how they perceived primary care included their appreciation that primary care physicians can build long-term relationships with patients and that primary care gives the opportunity to manage chronic health issues. Some negative responses received included poor compensation associated with primary care, uncontrollable hours in primary care, and that some medical students prefer to know one field really well and make other specialties look more appealing to them. The second survey was conducted of the clinical preceptors, and data was collected via phone interviews. The interviews set out to assess the role of the preceptor, gain better understanding of the challenges associated with that role. 25 interviews were conducted, and of these interviews, they included both clinical preceptors and non-preceptors, and the physicians interviewed were representative of both metro and outstate Minnesota. The length of service of the clinical preceptors ranged from 2 years to over 35 years experience. All physicians interviewed were primary care physicians, again, by that definition of family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics. Some of the reasons the physicians gave for serving as clinical preceptors included that they enjoyed teaching, thought that it was an important role, and they acknowledged the shortage of clinical preceptors and wanted to contribute. Some of the challenges identified included the amount of time that's required to serve in the role and the limited clinical training sites that are available. It's estimated that it takes an extra hour per half day just to have a medical student in your clinic with you, so you'll be there an extra hour every day or have half a day. One of our other big efforts was convening a primary care summit on workforce. The summit objectives included bringing physicians together to discuss ways to solve the primary care physician workforce shortage, educate physicians on the current state of the workforce shortage, and examine ways to transform physicians' practices in order to reinvigorate primary care. We had guest speakers from the American Association or the Association of American Medical Colleges and the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. We also had 3 panel discussions that focused on the economics and business side of primary care, the current state of medical education in Minnesota, and the primary care practice transformation. Next, I'd like to go through the 7 task force recommendations for expanding Minnesota's primary care physician workforce. These were approved by the MMA Board of Trustees on May 3rd. First, we have a recommendation that was deemed to be highest priority for the MMA. This recommendation addresses the lack of clinical training sites available in Minnesota, one of the barriers to expansion of the primary care physician workforce that's been identified by the task force. The recommendation reads as follows. The Minnesota Medical Association will work with health systems, hospitals, large practices, and state's medical schools to examine ways to increase the number of available clinical training sites in Minnesota and examine ways to remove barriers that exist in allowing medical students to have more meaningful experiences. The next four recommendations are what the task force put into the Minnesota State Legislative Package. These are recommendations that the task force felt state-level advocacy could bring about the greatest potential for change. The recommendations on this slide read as follows. The Minnesota Medical Association will address the high cost of medical school and the resulting medical school debt by supporting efforts that target loan forgiveness and loan repayment programs specifically to primary care, and that restores funding of levels to levels equal to or greater than those of 2008. The Minnesota Medical Association will support efforts to sustain beyond 2014 the Affordable Care Act required Medicaid payment bump for primary care, which increases primary care Medicaid rates to Medicare levels for 2013 and 14. On this slide, we have two additional recommendations that are included in the Minnesota State Legislative Package. The Minnesota Medical Association will further examine the feasibility of seeking a waiver from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that would provide for state management of the GME distribution in Minnesota. For example, the waiver could link GME funding, graduate medical education funding, to Minnesota's primary care physician workforce needs and set up a distribution mechanism. The second was the Minnesota Medical Association will promote the creation by the state legislature of a state medical education council that includes a representative from each of the state's medical schools and representatives from teaching hospitals and clinical training sites and other relevant stakeholders. The council would serve the purpose of providing analysis and policy guidance on how Minnesota can meet its physician workforce objectives. On this slide, we have recommendations that were categorized into a federal legislative package, as the task force felt this recommendation would have the greatest effect if brought forward for a national level advocacy through a vehicle such as the American Medical Association. The package represents a recommendation that would not be feasible to advocate for at a state level, as action requested would likely require federal legislation. The limited number of residency slots, as has been discussed, was addressed by the task force as a barrier to expansion. But understanding that the cap on the number of residency slots has existed since 1997 and that the likelihood of lifting this cap is not very likely, it's not really feasible. The task force wanted to address the need for additional GME funding as a way to ensure that additional training slots were not lost. The recommendation reads as follows. The Minnesota Medical Association will advocate that the 2011 Budget Control Act cut funding to Medicare-supported graduate medical education, that those levels be restored and maintained at levels prior to the sequestration, which took effect in April 2013. The Minnesota Medical Association should take a leadership role in advocating for an adequate number of residency slots, an adequate number of faculty and adjunct faculty support, and the required resources to increase the number of primary care residency slots. On this slide is a task force final recommendation. It's a recommendation for the MMA policy position that requires no further action. The task force members had identified primary care income as a barrier to expansion of the primary care physician workforce. Understanding the complexities involved with advocating for increasing income levels in one specialty versus another, the task force wanted to include this income recommendation as an acknowledgement that income does play a role in specialty choice, and the number of primary care physicians might increase if their income was brought closer to the income of some of the other specialties. The recommendation reads that the Minnesota Medical Association acknowledges the role that income plays in specialty choice and believes that the primary care physician capacity could be improved if this disparity were addressed. That's a summary of our task force report and recommendations. The staff is now beginning the next step in this effort, which is the implementation phase of the recommendations. They're working to decide how to best approach each of the recommendations and what partners and resources will be needed to achieve their goals. Expanding our primary care physician workforce is about more than just increasing the supply. It's also about reinvigorating the practice of primary care, to keep the number of physicians we have, and to make the profession more attractive to young physicians. On behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association, I want to thank you for holding today's meeting and for your support of Minnesota's primary care physician workforce. The MMA looks forward to the work of the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission and to serving as a resource in your efforts. I'll be happy to address any questions you have.
Dr. Springer, I agree that geriatrics should be included in here, but are geriatricians, are they considered primary care in the rest of the country?
Yes, they are. It's by age, actually. It's in the same way that pediatricians are primary care for young children or for children. Geriatricians are primary care for many older folks, especially those that are living in nursing homes or that are in the general population. Several of the large provider systems in town have senior service departments that are manned with geriatricians who are trained both in internal medicine or family medicine and then provide care for those seniors. There's also a move, within, if you haven't noticed all the high-rises that are going up in town, for independent assisted living and then memory units that have been put together in one large building. And geriatricians provide a lot of the care in that. There's a couple of models, one Bluestone comes out of Stillwater, where they actually kind of pull up with three vans and have x-ray and lab and three or four providers and physical therapy, and everybody else kind of comes to the center where everyone lives, sees the patients, and then they leave. Rather than the patients coming to them, they come to the patients. So, again, geriatrics is definitely a part of primary care.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative, or Senator Kiffmeyer. I knew I'd screw that up.
Works just fine. Sometimes Mary, too.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Springer, thank you for the report. Very interesting, and I can see that a lot of thought and work went into it, and that's very helpful to us as a commission. My question relates to a New York Times article that is in our packet having to do with actually the VA, Department of Veterans Affairs, but their comment was about the problem not only being the shortage of doctors, but an imbalance in the use of existing resources. In other words, the imbalance being a lot of specialties and not enough primary care. It seems as though the implication is from this anyway, or they say too many specialists and too few primary care. We've had this discussion about the federal government and their ratio of what they do since 1997. Do you think that your workforce would also have an interest in concurring with wanting the federal government to balance that out since 1997 and to take a look at helping in this regard of more primary care doctors by the federal government slots being rebalanced so we have more of a focus on the primary care physician area. Would you like to comment in regards to that kind of an effort as in addition to all these other good things you have here as well?
Senator Kiffmeyer would be happy to do that. Mr. Chairman, the federal government actually pays hospitals by number of residency slots. And traditionally, those were already set up in specialties. But the hospitals can spend that money in different ways. Regents Hospital is a good example. When they closed their family medicine residency, they reallocated those slots for fellowships, for subspecialty fellowships. So there is some guidance from the Fed, but they don't absolutely control who goes to what specialty. AMA and some other groups will have a large input into that. The AAMC, which we talked about a little bit on predicting the shortage, has recommended that the increase in residency slots be 60% for primary care and 40% for subspecialty care. There's also a decrease in the number. There's not enough dermatologists. If you've ever tried to get into a dermatologist, it takes 6 months. So it takes a long time. So there are also lack of certain other specialties. And as the population ages, some of those other specialties will be around. I think part of the problem with the VA was getting at is that things that could be done in primary care are oftentimes taken to a subspecialist. And rather than one doctor taking care of three problems, you have three doctors taking care of three different problems. They don't always talk to each other. They often repeat a lot of work from that the other does. And so you don't have good coordination of care. We've talked about things like primary care home and other things to kind of get around some of that, where we have a primary care physician kind of coordinating that care from across that in a system and avoiding some of the duplication, and that's where a lot of the cost run-up comes. So, I'm all for reallocating slots for primary care. I'm 100% behind that. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Springer, I'm interested on pages 13 and 14, your legislative package. You brought up a number of things where you support efforts to target loan forgiveness and loan repayment and restoring funds. Did you tie any numbers to those efforts or those repayments? I notice you're going back to 2008. Budgets are put together by numbers. So do you have any rough numbers that you are looking at?
I don't have them off the top of my head. The 2008 cut, I think, was when we were balancing the budget a bit in the state, and there were some general cuts across the systems. And the Rural Loan Forgiveness Program was part of that. And I think it was cut by a couple of million dollars. I know right now the funding is around one, and I think it was around three or something like that in the past.
Yeah, Dr. Springer, you're generalization of cuts in higher education, in particular in Minnesota, we had some of the largest cuts to higher education in the nation, particularly to the University of Minnesota.
Right.
We had perhaps the largest cuts to a university its size. The result was record tuition, double digits for a
right.
series of years. And what I'm also interested in, did the Medical Association take a stand on those cuts or the tuition increases? Or did they give us any indication of the size of the debts that were coming at us as a result of this?
I can tell you the average debt for medical students coming out of the University of Minnesota is around $140,000. Some of them are in excess of $200,000 or $250,000. So it's a fairly significant debt load that they come out with. And I can tell you as someone who teaches residents that when they pick where they're going as far as the distribution and which systems they're going to go work for, loan repayment is something that they look at quite strongly.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Springer, I'm aware of the size of the debt. What we were not aware of as a legislative body was any indication from higher ed that this debt was coming at us. When the cuts were made, there was a general compliance that it could be absorbed by tuition. There was no next step saying that when you start doing this, these record tuition increases, there was a consequence. And the consequence, in part, you just said, were debts. So my problem is that when these cuts were happening, higher ed in particular sat there and didn't say anything, except we'll fix it with tuition increases. And only at the very end did the previous president of the U in his last year make statements, public statements, that there was a problem happening. So did your organization say, as we were making these cuts in 2008 and prior to 2008, that there was a consequence to tuition increases of a record amount and then to the sizable debt?
Dr. Mayor.
Yes.
No, go ahead.
Representative, I can't speak for the MMA personally other than kind of at the workforce because I can't give you, I don't know. I'm not privy to what goes on at the university per se either. So I can't answer your question.
Representative Holly and Dr. Springer, it might be slightly unfair, but the point of all of this is that while this was going on, there was no complaint about what was happening in higher education. Now, for the last 2 years, we froze tuition, undergraduate tuition.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a corollary to that, too. The university can make it up in another area called graduate tuition.
Right.
And we're just beginning now to put the data together for 2015 to see if we can continue with the freezing of tuition at the undergraduate level, and then what's going to happen at the graduate level. Because that can't continue either. Your rough numbers are appalling. How do you go out and start a practice when you're carrying hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt? If you can put numbers to any of this, it is extremely helpful, because we are taking a look at what's happening with both tuition and debt, and what happens when we're looking at primary care or any type of care. These are critical issues that we're going to have to take a look at as a state.
Representative, we could certainly make a stab at that, at answering those questions, but we'll probably go out and do a little research ourselves. So.
Well, Mr. Chair and Dr. Springer, my other favorite question to ask when individuals come to us and they're asking for sizable sums of money, are they going to then support the source for the sizable sums of money? It's called a revenue increase or a tax increase. You don't have to ask it or answer it today, but this doesn't fall out of the sky.
Not speaking as a representative for the MMA, but personally I do have some opinions as far as where the money could come from. But
well,
we can talk about that.
If you have opinions, Mr. Chair, Dr. Sprink, if you have opinions, we're open to hear them.
Okay.
Because I don't think you're going to see the 2015 legislature spend $2 billion in new revenue. So we're going to be looking for sources.
If I could just say something nice about the MMA. Their report on the primary care physician workforce is extremely unusual for a state medical association to sort of gently get in between the specialists versus the primary care doctor. And in Minnesota, they can do that. And in most other states, that would never, ever have happened.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just encouraging them to do it. Because without resources, none of this is going to happen. And your problem is an extraordinary one.
Well, I give you some numbers, but they're like 10 years out of date. But family practice docs used to make about $150,000 a year. And radiologists and most of the other specialists were making $400,000, $500,000 a year. And my wife's neurosurgeon, who was a very good neurosurgeon and a very nice guy, who was making, back then, $950,000 a year. Now, personally, I think neurosurgeons ought to make a little more, since most of them have done 10 years of residencies and fellowships, and they all ought to quit doing neurosurgery when they're about 60. So they should get paid a little more, but that's a dramatic difference.
Well, Mr. Chair, in 2012, the University of Minnesota came out with its initial budget request in August. I expect that they're probably looking at a budget proposal that will come out in August of this year also. I would hope that this year, while the focus will still be on undergraduate, and it looks like they're going to propose some type of a freeze or stabilization of tuition, I would hope that we would begin to see what's going to happen in graduate tuition at the university. At all levels, and what the cost would be for some type of freeze or stabilization there. So the issue is a real one, because I expect to see higher ed budgets coming out in August and September of this year in anticipation of the legislative session. And your assistance would be most welcome.
Thank you. Any further questions for Dr. Springer? Thank you very much for
Thank
your
you.
Testimony, and congratulations on your report
Thank you.
That you came up with. We have on the agenda a list of items to think about. Number one is identifying current and anticipated healthcare workforce shortages, both by provider type and geography. Two is evaluate the effectiveness of incentives currently available. Three, study alternative incentives to develop, attract, and retain highly skilled, diverse healthcare workforce. And four, identify current causes and potential solutions to barriers related to primary care workforce, including but not limited to training and residency shortages. And some other things. And I would also remind the members that this looks at the entire healthcare. This commission is supposed to look at the entire healthcare workforce, not just physicians or primary care, but where the needs are going to be and how we're going to go about meeting house. And so if you would look at these things and send Senator Clausen or myself a list of if you want to add things or you think there's things in there we don't need, and then we could adjust the agenda for the next meeting. Senator Lord.
You know, Representative Huntley, on item four there, and I saw in the MMA's presentation, they talk about negative perceptions of primary care among students. And, you know, I mean, the perceptions are, when we talk to doctors, you know, I mean, like when we had that MMA meeting up in Duluth, you and I, and we started talking about this, it's not just a perception issue. I mean, there's real pressures that come to bear on the primary care workforce, and that's why they're telling the students, you know, my God, we really have a tremendous amount of regulatory burdens, and and the salaries aren't there. So it's not just even the perceptions. It's, you know, I mean, we got to really look at the realities that a primary care physician lives with day to day, I think, and would like some help in trying to figure out, you know, with the MMA, how to work through some of those issues. I mean, that's something that we constantly hear when we go out and talk to them, that, you know, all of the things that we measure, it falls to the primary care workforce to deliver on those measurements. And we need to measure, and we need to ask for accountability, but it really has added a burden where, you know, where we're trying to make this an attractive place to work, and it just keeps, I think we tend to add to it. And so it's a little bit more than negative perceptions. I think there's some realities there that we really need to address as well and include as part of the discussion, at least.
Other comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, just going to ask you quick.
Representative Kiffmeyer, or Senator Kiffmeyer.
It's okay.
I did that forever when you came over, too. I'm on to it now, though. I called Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay. And are the comments that we did make today about some of those going to be already included, that we don't need to repeat that again in regards to the federal apportionment of those things, that would be included? That was discussed. I don't want to duplicate communicating again.
How we fund graduate medical education is a very complicated and hard to understand thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think we need somebody to come in and explain it to us, hopefully in simple terms. For instance, if you're a hospital that sees a lot of lower income people, you get more for graduate medical education, even though there's not a real justification for that particular thing. Not that I'm going against hospitals to take care of lower-income people, but what's the reality for that balance? But that's the way the federal law is. And we need someone to come in and explain that to us in simple terms, because it's a very complicated thing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Pulaski.
If the University in Minsky will have their budgets that they are going to propose to the legislature in 2015 ready in August or September or October, I think it might be a good idea that they come present the budgets built around these issues. So how are those budgets going to address the issues in here? I agree, and particularly at the university, the graduate budget is an intriguing maze. But it hasn't really been looked at in conjunction with both higher ed and, as we've seen here, health and human services. So it would be, I think, a good idea to request that we hear from both groups how they're going to do it. I'm going to be down at Minsky with the trustees tomorrow. They have charting the future. They have 8 task forces that they're launching for the next 3 to 5 years. I assume, although I don't know, that one of them has got to be dealing with this. So maybe we should find out how. And if you don't want to make the request, I'll start tomorrow.
We can certainly do that. We have a university person up there.
Oh, yes, I see now.
I will say that the university is in a very difficult position. They have two contradictory missions. One is to attract the kind of faculty that can get Nobel Prizes. No one's ever going to get a Nobel Prize in family medicine. Even whoever came up, actually was a pediatrician who came up with the healthcare home, should have gotten a Nobel Prize for that, but you're not going to get Nobel Prizes in primary care. On the other side of it is the university's job is also to train the workforce that the state needs. And how do you balance that?
Well, Mr. Chair, even inside Minsky, they have something now called differential tuition, particularly in the nursing programs. It isn't well advertised, but it's there. That differential tuition is something that doesn't appear to function when we do tuition freezes and other things, and yet it's integral to health care. So all of these budgets and where this, is it at the university or college level that decision is made, or is it at the system level? And yet they're making it. Now, I realize there were cuts, but we are now in a process of investing. So I'd like to have an understanding of how that investment's going to work, as opposed to things like differential tuition, particularly in healthcare.
Other questions? I don't see any. So why don't we? Senator Clausen and I will set up a date for the next meeting, and we'll try to go through this stuff. And if any of you have any suggestions about what you need to know, send it to either one of us, and we'll get together and get the next meeting set. So with that, the meeting is adjourned. Mm-hmm.